it looks like it's terrible because it's this rainbow color, and that's very, very thin, so there's not a whole lot of oil there.
A mile-long oil sheen from a boat sinking near Sitka from the Alaska Public Radio Network. This is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, August 9th. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, studying a productive area of the Chukchi Sea near Shell's drill sites.
Anything that goes in the water at the drill sites may end up in this very productive region.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. And by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
Two Montana women have died in an Eagle River boating accident. Anchorage Police Department spokesman Lieutenant Dave Parker says the two, identified as 60-year-old Fern Johnson and 48-year-old Carol Heater, were in a canoe that overturned, dumping the women and a third occupant into the river. The third person, Robert Johnson, Fern Johnson's husband, was rescued. Parker says the emergency call came in around 4 p.m. on Wednesday.
They were all in the same canoe, descending Eagle River, but about mile 7.4, they encountered a log jam that was pretty much blocking the whole river. But they swept up against the log jam in fairly slow-moving water, and then as they paddled towards the east bank, they got into faster-moving water, which caught the canoe and overturned it.
Parker says Robert Johnson managed to climb on top of the logjam, but the women...
They had actually been swept underneath the logjam, and both of them were drowned.
All three accident victims were wearing life vests. A fourth person in the party, Eagle River resident Robert Voorhis, following in a kayak, was not harmed. Parker says the three Montana residents had only arrived in the state Wednesday afternoon. This is the second canoe accident in a month that has resulted in lives lost. In July, two out-of-state men drowned when their canoe overturned in Matanuska Lake. An Alaska-based paratrooper from Idaho has been killed in Afghanistan. U.S. Army Alaska says that Specialist Ethan Jacob Martin of Lewiston, Idaho, died Tuesday when his unit was attacked by small arms fire in Korigay, Afghanistan. Three other soldiers also were injured. The Army says the 22-year-old Martin was assigned as a cavalry scout to the 1st Squadron, 40th Cavalry Regiment, 4th Brigade Combat Team, 25th Infantry Division. He joined the Army in October of 2009 and was assigned to Joint Base Elmendorf Richardson in Anchorage in March of 2010. The 3,500-soldier brigade went to Afghanistan in December. A response team is in Slocum Arm, north of Sitka, tending to oil leaking from a seine boat. The 50-foot Evening Star sank while fishing on August 2nd. The vessel is about 40 miles northwest of Sitka, along the southwestern part of Chichagof Island. The vessel reportedly had 1,000 gallons of diesel aboard. A mile-long sheen was seen on Tuesday, but as KCAW's Ed Ronco reports, state environmental officials say the amount of oil coming from the boat is relatively light.
The oil sheen was visible during an overflight by the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. A smaller sheen was visible immediately after the sinking, and it prompted an emergency closure of the nearby salmon fishery. State officials say no impacts to fish or wildlife have been reported, but responders are working to contain the oil. Scott Tiernan is with the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation.
But it's still a sheen, and I'd like to stress that a sheen is a very small quantity of oil. If it's a sheen, there's not much there. It looks like it's terrible because it's this rainbow color, and that's very, very thin, so there's not a whole lot of oil there.
Tiernan said when the vessel went down, the vents on its fuel tank were sealed. What's visible in the water is probably engine oil of some sort. A DEC situation report said the engine room holds approximately 25 gallons of lube oil and a 160-gallon hydraulic oil tank. A response team from SeaPro deployed from Sitka to contain the oil. SeaPro stands for the Southeast Alaska Petroleum Resource Organization. The Ketchikan-based group responds to oil spills.
The plan is to try to get boom around the vessel, so if anything is coming up, that they can try to corral it there and then try to pick it up. The oil that's already gotten out will have evaporated quite a bit, so there's even less out there than initially came out. So collecting the stuff that's a mile away from the vessel probably is not practical.
Tiernan says responders are also keeping their eye on the shoreline.
There is a stream in the area that we believe is an anadromous stream or a salmon-bearing stream. And one of the things CPRO will be doing is they will be putting what is known as a deflection boom out to try to keep the oil away from the mouth of that stream.
The crew of the Evening Star escaped safely and was transported back to Sitka by a Good Samaritan vessel. The 50-foot seiner, meanwhile, is nose down with about 10 feet of water over its stern. Operations on removing fuel from the vessel and salvaging it are scheduled to begin next week. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
A group of scientists aboard the Coast Guard icebreaker Healy are heading to the Arctic to study an important ecosystem downstream of drill sites in the Chukchi Sea. KUCB's Stephanie Joyce caught up with some of the researchers before they boarded the ship.
Hanna Shoal is a shallow, 30-mile-long shelf off the coast of northwest Alaska. It's one of the Chukchi Sea's most biologically productive spots and an important feeding area for walrus and bowhead whales. It's also just downstream of a number of oil and gas leases, including one of Shell's exploratory drill sites.
So anything that goes in the water at the drill sites may end up in this very productive region.
Karen Ashon is a senior scientist at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute. She's one of a dozen researchers participating in a five-year, $5.6 million study of Hanna Shoal. The Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, or BOEM, is footing the bill for the work. BOEM oceanographer Heather Crowley says the data will help inform future policy decisions about the region.
As they decide on where the energy policy for the Outer Continental Shelf goes in the future, where to potentially sell leases and for approval of future development and production plans proposed by industry.
Hanna Shoal has been studied before, but never comprehensively. The team aboard the Healy is planning to look at all aspects of the area's ecosystem, from the worms that live in the seafloor sediments to the krill in the water column and the currents that push everything around. Lead scientist Ken Dunton says his goal is to understand how that all fits together.
Not only to understand who's related to who, who's eating who, who's hunting whom, but in the end, you know, how are toxins, whether they be heavy metals or whether they be polyaromatic hydrocarbons, going to be transferred through the food web to the highest trophic levels.
The highest trophic levels being the whales and walrus. Dunton says scientists have a hard time understanding how the Deepwater Horizon oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico changed the food web there because they didn't have baseline data.
They're reporting all kinds of interesting responses by the community. Well, did some of those conditions exist previously? We don't know.
Collecting data about Hanna Shoal now, before drilling starts in earnest, should make it easier to understand its impacts later. But there's a complicating factor, sea ice retreat. Declining annual sea ice is changing Hanna Shoal's ecosystem, even as the group tries to establish a baseline. Dunton says that will ultimately need to factor into any model of how human activities are impacting the area.
Scientists, as nerdy as we are, we have quite a task in front of us. And that's why we bring to bear, you know, young minds, grad students, postdocs, to help us senior scientists figure out how to separate these two confounding developments.
The Healy team will spend 2 weeks sampling on and near Hanna Shoal, and then will leave instruments behind to continue monitoring until the ship returns again next summer. In Unalaska, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, finding inspiration at the Renewable Energy Fair in Anchorage.
He's building zero net energy homes, meaning he's building homes right now in Fairbanks that produce just as much energy as they use.
Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. A PFD reminder, check the status of your 2012 PFD application with MyPFD Info online at pfd.alaska.gov. You can view or change your voluntary deductions until Friday, August 31st. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
A search continues for an Anchorage woman missing for nearly a week. 63-year-old Letitia Baxter was last seen August 3rd after leaving her sister's residence in downtown Anchorage. Baxter said she was going to walk a few blocks to do errands and failed to return. Anchorage Police Department spokesperson Marlene Lammers says Baxter was familiar with the city's trail system and walked almost everywhere.
Yesterday, the APD search team, which is a group of volunteers for the police department, they were able to go out and search the trail system. So they were searching areas that she's familiar with and that she's known to frequent, looking for her. She has not been found as of yet.
Family and friends are continuing to search for Baxter. Lammers says investigators so far are not suspecting foul play.
We're not suspecting any foul play, but at this point in time, we're not going to rule anything out because we just don't know what happened to her.
Baxter is the daughter of Vaughn and Ruth Baxter, who homesteaded East Anchorage in the mid-1940s. Enbridge Incorporated is proposing to build a pipeline that would transport oil sands crude 730 miles from Alberta, Canada, to the coast of British Columbia. From there, the pipeline would fill supertankers headed primarily to China. The fastest route takes them straight through Alaska waters. KSTK's Ann Hillman has more about how the proposed project could impact the state.
The proposed Northern Gateway pipeline would give Canadian oil sands developers access to growing markets in Asia. The pipeline would be able to transport up to 525,000 barrels of the bitumen condensate mixture every day to be loaded into supertankers. Bitumen is heavy, thick black oil. If the project goes through, every year 220 tankers would travel in and out of Kitimat, British Columbia, carrying condensate to the pipeline and shipping the bitumen mixture away. Once the tankers left Canadian waters, they would cross Dixon Entrance, cutting perpendicularly across the shipping lanes coming to and from Southeast Alaska and Seattle. A new Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation vessel traffic study shows that traffic in that area is already significantly increasing, with more ships coming in and out of Prince Rupert. DEC State On-Scene Coordinator Scott Tiernan says more traffic in that area means more risks.
There's always a risk. When you have two vessels out there going in perpendicular directions, there's always a risk. But you also have a very big ocean, so the risk of coming together is fairly small. But it's one of those things that you call low probability, high consequence type of risk.
The risk of an accident continues as tankers move further along the Great Circle Route to the Bering Sea and the Aleutian Islands, home to fisheries valued at $2.5 billion a year. Leslie Pearson is coordinating the Aleutian Island Risk Assessment. She says that currently about 4,000 vessels of all types travel the Great Circle Route every year, carrying dry goods, oil, fuel, and other cargo. That's more than initially was thought. Traveling through the Aleutians is risky because of the volatile weather and the remoteness. Access to accident prevention equipment, like emergency towing packages and tugboats, is limited. Pearson says some areas pose more risks than others.
The Unimak Pass is essentially one of the pinch points for the Aleutians. That's of an area concern because there have been other accidents in that area or near misses historically, and the proximity to shoreline is where your risk could, your greater risks occur.
And if accidents in the Aleutians do occur, like the 2004 grounding of the Selandang IU on Unalaska Island, it's hard to clean up after them, especially if it involves a large ship like a supertanker.
Well, the size can be a real challenge because of the limited salvage capability out in the Aleutians, and as well as the amount of product that they're carrying.
The Aleutian Islands Risk Assessment Team is working to put systems in place to ensure that the people there don't find out. But Karen Wistrin of the Living Oceans Marine Protection Organization says that even if groups could respond quickly to a spill of bitumen mixed with condensate in the Aleutians, they couldn't start immediately containing it.
That condensate is extremely volatile, with the result that after a spill, you can expect there to be a vapor cloud around the spill that would prevent human beings from getting near it. It's hydrogen sulfide, which is extremely poisonous, and it's benzene and toluene, which are carcinogens.
But representatives from Enbridge say shipping bitumen is safe and enough precautions are in place to alleviate fears of a spill. Keith Michel is a naval architect working with Enbridge. He says that international law mandates that all tankers carrying all types of oil must be double-hulled.
And the primary reason for that is the mitigation of the risk of outflow in the case of an accident, a striking vessel or running aground. The probability of penetrating into the oil tanks is greatly reduced by a double-hull tanker.
He also says that the ships have to undergo comprehensive inspections every 5 years and visual inspections every year to check that the walls and tanks of the ship are still thick enough and have minimal corrosion. He adds that new regulations will also require coating the cargo tanks of oil carriers to reduce corrosion there as well. Captain Jerry Aspland, the retired president of ARCO Marine, is also working with Enbridge. He says that the tankers that would transport bitumen from Northern Gateway would pose no more risks than any other ship traveling the Great Circle route.
Tankers run through all waters of the world with all kinds of cargo, and it's no different than what it is today. Bitumen is within the scope of crudes that tankers are able to carry, and they should have no additional concerns about ships carrying this product.
Enbridge would not be responsible for building or maintaining the tankers used to ship the bitumen, nor would they be liable for any accidents should they occur. That would fall to the companies buying the oil. At present, multiple companies have invested in the project with the intent to buy, including Canada's Suncor Energy and China's Sinopec Corporation. The proposed Northern Gateway Pipeline project is currently undergoing public and government review processes in Canada. If it's approved in 2013, shipping could begin in 2017. For KSTK, I'm Ann Hillman.
The 8th Annual Renewable Energy Alaska Project, or REAP, Fair is taking place Saturday in Anchorage. Chris Rose is the executive director of REAP, a nonprofit that promotes renewable energy in Alaska. He says this year there'll be more than 40 booths at the REAP Fair.
Some of those are informational booths. Some are craft vendors. Some are food vendors. We have a beer tent there. We also have a bunch of people with electric and alternative vehicles, some that are homemade that'll be there that people can come and check out. But I think that what people like to do is come and just look at all the information that's out there, listen to the music, sit in the grass, and go to a few workshops.
REAP is a nonprofit coalition of more than 80 energy stakeholders from around the state. Their mission is to increase the production of renewable energy in Alaska. At Saturday's fair, there will be 19 workshops on everything from tidal power to how to make your home more energy efficient.
One of the workshops I really want to see myself is Thorsten Schlup's workshop that'll be at 2 o'clock on living with the Arctic sun. He is a designer and builder up in Fairbanks, and he's building zero net energy homes, meaning he's building homes right now in Fairbanks that produce just as much energy as they use. So that's at 2 o'clock. That's going to be a very informational workshop that I hope a lot of people can catch.
Music will include Evan Phillips, Tim Easton, Rebel Blues, and more. The REAP Fair runs from 11 to 9 on Saturday on Anchorage's Park Strip.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Juneau International Airport is asking the Federal Aviation Administration for $2 million to install additional approach lighting to the east end of its main runway. The city-owned airport has already $1 million for the project, thanks to a 2010 earmark inserted into a transportation bill by Senator Lisa Murkowski. But airport manager Jeannie Johnson says that only pays for 3 lights when ideally there should be at least 8. Even with modern advances in aircraft navigation, Johnson says Alaska Airlines estimates it had more than 450 missed approaches to Juneau last year. The majority of those flights eventually landed, she says, but only after taking another pass.
Alaska Airlines is excited to get even three on that end of the airport because it helps them get into Juneau more often when they've got more lights down there to see when the weather's really bad.
Alaska's congressional delegation is backing the airport's request. Senator Murkowski and Congressman Don Young have written letters of support to acting FAA Administrator Michael Huerta. Johnson says she expects Senator Mark Begich to do the same by the end of the week. If the request is unsuccessful, Johnson says the scaled-down project will move forward on the east end of the main runway early next year. The west end already has a full system of approach lights. There's a reason the Chilkat Valley is called the Valley of Eagles. Thousands of bald eagles thrive in the valley near Haines and the Tlingit village of Klukwan. The communities gathered recently to honor the anniversary of a preserve created to protect the eagles and their habitat. Margaret Friedenauer from member station KHNS reports.
There's a reason the Chilkat Valley is called the Valley of the Eagles. About 40 years ago, biologists and residents in the Chilkat Valley began to recognize the area had one of the most impressive gatherings of bald eagles at almost any time of year. Tlingits in the village of Klukwan and throughout the area had this knowledge for generations. But it was in the late 70s and early 80s that Haines residents began a collaborative effort to protect the eagles and waters and habitat that supports them. This year is the 30th anniversary of the results of that effort, the designation of the 48,000-acre Chilkat Bald Eagle Preserve. Last weekend, dozens of Haines residents and guests rafted the rivers through the area to celebrate the preserve. The trip began on the Sirku River. The preserve includes lands along the Sirku, Klahini, and Chilkat rivers, where more than 4,000 eagles congregate annually to feed on spawning salmon. Eagles can usually be spotted any time of year throughout the preserve. And the anniversary celebration raft trip was no exception.
There's an eagle out there, and an immature eagle, just watching us go by.
The rafters met up with the Chilkat River before the trip ended at the village of Klukwan. Visitors were welcomed by Tribal President Jones Hotch into the longhouse at the village. Haines Mayor Stephanie Scott touched on the controversy that surrounded the creation of the preserve in 1982. It was created when Alaska passed legislation to protect and preserve habitat areas throughout the state. She mentioned that at the height of the Alaska land debate, Governor Jay Hammond and U.S. senators began receiving more letters on the Chilkat Bald Eagle controversy than any other issue.
The issue was how to protect and simultaneously allow for use and development of valuable timber and mineral resources.
Emotions in Haines and Klukwan ran high during that time. Haines historian Dan Henry described the meeting that finally brought about agreement. 15 stakeholders, including federal agencies, conservationists, miners, and loggers, came to an impasse. But Mother Nature helped them out.
They hit a standstill. They couldn't go anywhere. And so they're all going to fly out and say, well, we're going to try it again sometime. But as things often happen around here, a blizzard moved in, and nobody could fly anywhere. And so eventually, I think Ray Menneker mentioned to me, he said, you know, I just said, well, let's have dinner, and then we'll go back and meet. And they met until 3 in the morning that morning, and finally they came to an agreement that everybody could live with.
Only 14 of the parties signed the agreement. The village of Klukwan did not sign, but Henry said they let it be known they would cooperate with efforts of the preserve.
And the reason that they did not sign is that, you know, Klukwan has always had this Chilkat Ani, this entire area, 2.6 million acres, from Point Sherman up to the passes, and Klukwan was not willing to sign off any part of that. But at the same time, they agreed that they would be cooperative partners.
Disagreements about uses in the preserve still exist. Some conservation groups are critical of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game for not studying the impacts of commercial jet boats on salmon habitat. The groups say the lack of protective restrictions does not fulfill the spirit of the law that created the preserve. But Henry emphasized that the process undertaken still stands as a positive example of citizens collaborating on the goal of resource management.
And in fact, it started a whole new trend in resource management throughout the country. And we were the first ones where regular people from different stakeholder groups came together, sat down, and figured it out, rather than have kind of the top-down, the feds move in or the state moves in and says, okay, we're going to do it this way.
Klukwan hosted a lunch for the guests after the Chilkat Kwan dancers performed in the longhouse. In Haines, this is Margaret Friednauer.
State Fish and Game authorities will close sports silver salmon fishing in some Matanuska Valley creeks on Friday. The order comes on the heels of Northern District set net restrictions announced today. The Friday closure affects the Little Susitna River, while further restrictions are in effect for other Knik Arm drainages. Sam Ivey, the area management biologist in Palmer, says this summer is the third in a row for low silver salmon returns to the Little Sioux. Ivey says fish counters at a weir on the Little Sioux indicate that daily silver counts are lower than escapement goals.
The daily counts right now are fairly low. We did pass a little over 200 fish yesterday, but the counts had varied between 20 and 200 fish, and we should be seeing normally counts of around 500 a day at that site. So at this time, because the projection is so low, even using a late run timing model, every fish counts basically at this point. We need to do as much for savings as we can.
The Little Susitna historically has been the second largest sport fishery for silvers in Alaska, second only to the Kenai River. Ivy says silver salmon escapement goals on the Little Sioux have not been met since 2009. Silver salmon runs vary in timing, Ivy says, and there is still a chance that runs could improve. He says last year returns for silver salmon were pretty dismal across the entire Cook Inlet region. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org or follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ed Ronco in Sitka, Stephanie Joyce in on Alaska, Ann Hillman in Wrangell, Dacia Eaton in Anchorage, Casey Kelly in Juneau, and Margaret Friednauer in Haines. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
A recent statewide survey by Dittman Research show that 65% of Alaskans think it's time to build the Knik Arm Crossing, and 77% of those surveyed believe the bridge will save Alaskans time, money, and provide our economy with needed jobs. For facts on the Knik Arm Bridge, visit knikarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Knik Arm Bridge and Toll Authority. The Rasmussen Foundation sabbatical program offers nonprofit executives and tribal leaders paid time away from their jobs for personal renewal and growth, and organizations often become stronger as a result. October 1st is the deadline to apply. Learn more at Rasmussen.org. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.